Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. Jane Hoffman will be conducting the show. John Yoder will be joining us sometime in the next hour. Tonight I am reading two excerpts from the Origin of the Casa Maria House in Milwaukee, started by Michael Cullen and his wife, Nettie. I am also reading from Lawrence Rosebaugh's autobiography, To Wisdom Through Failure, A Journey of Compassion, Resistance, and Hope. He wrote the book, and he is Oblate Mary Immaculate Priest. I'm going to start in Chapter 5, The Catholic Worker. That's the subtitle of the chapter. So he's already become a priest. He served 3 to 5 years as a teacher in St. Paul in Duluth, Minnesota. He had also spent a summer teaching in Chicago, but he was itching to help the poorest of the poor. So I'm going to start with this chapter. Walking into the Catholic Worker House in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, felt to me like a dream come true. I was finally coming to work where I had longed to work, but it was more than this that put wings under my feet. It was the blessing I had from the Oblates. My superior had told me, "You are free to go there since you see this as fulfilling the charisma of Eugene de Mazenod, identifying with the most abandoned and oppressed and trying to be the voice for the voiceless." By the way, Eugene de Mazenod, who was born, I believe, in 1826 in France, he was the Oblates of the Mary Immaculate Order that Father Larry Rosebaugh belonged to. Going back to the book now, this is what Dorothy Day had in mind when she began the Catholic Worker Movement along with Peter Morin in the early 1930s. It was mid-August 1968, and I was all of 33 years of age, ordained a mere 5 years, idealistic and needing to be challenged and needing to taste to some degree the suffering that so many in our United States know too well. Mike Cullen and his wife, Nettie, early in their marriage, had moved into a Spanish area on the south side of Milwaukee and opened the Casa Maria, Mary's House, inspired by Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker Movement. Not long after its opening, they decided to move to the center of the city, close to more of the city's down and out. It was only a year or two after they moved to the Marquette University area that I arrived. Providentially, in April of that year, 1968, I had run into Mike and Nettie attending a talk given by Daniel Berrigan in Chicago. We were introduced, and in that brief time we had to share and get acquainted, I learned that they would be more than happy to have me in their community in Milwaukee. I'm pausing a moment. Daniel Berrigan is the brother of Philip Berrigan, who Larry Rosebaugh had met while he was in the seminary. So Phil was the athletic one, Dan was more of the cerebral one. Martin Luther King had been assassinated just the day before Dan was to give his talk. The news had us all in a state of shock, and we all felt the need to help to put this tragedy into a proper perspective. I remember distinctly two things that occurred that evening. The time we spent in silence, dealing interiorly with King's death and Dan's addressing the war in Vietnam. It wasn't so much what Dan said about the war that stayed with me, but an incident that happened while Dan was speaking to us. One moment while I drink. When Dan finished his talk, he asked, as usual, if there were any questions. A man in the last row of seats rose. He got directly to the point. "I've just returned from fighting in Vietnam, and I want you to know I don't agree with anything that you've said," he announced. We were aghast since Dan was our hero, and we assumed that everyone in the room agreed with his criticism of the war. What happened then, I will never forget. Dan moved down the center aisle until he was close to the young man, and addressing him in a most disarming manner, Dan thanked him for coming that evening and asked if he'd mind sharing how he saw the Vietnam conflict. The young man was taken aback at Dan's total lack of defensiveness. He began by defending our country's presence in Vietnam, while Dan listened attentively to every word indicating what the young veteran was saying, in which it was an extreme importance to him. Dan would occasionally ask for a further explanation or slowly begin to express his view of how and why the United States got involved in Vietnam and how the conflict had taken so many innocent lives, especially those of children and women and elderly. The tension disappeared from the exchange, and the desire to learn and understand what the other was saying took over. And what in reality was happening was that entire assembly became totally involved in the dialogue. The most important thing we took home with us that evening was a lesson in respect and concern for what the other had to say. I carried Dan's lesson with me when I entered the Catholic worker community at Casa Maria, a house of hospitality serving families who were without home, work, or food. Here I would need to practice listening as Dan had taught. The day of my arrival, Mike and Nettie and the volunteers working and living in the Casa community welcomed me. At the evening meal, Mike offered to take me for a walk around the neighborhood to see for myself its general state of deterioration. Mike explained that there was a pressure to get rid of the area of the poor, mostly African-American community living there, so as to sell the property for the expansion of Marquette University or local businesses that they wished to move in. As for me, I was in seventh heaven in a community whose sole raison d'être was to serve the most abandoned and be a voice for the voiceless. It really seemed to be an answer to my prayers, an opportunity to live out Eugene de Mazenod's charisma or charism. Within a day or two, I was at home, high up on a ladder, painting the second story of the house, setting the tables and washing dishes after the evening meal, changing diapers or putting kids to bed. Already I felt I belonged because it was truly a community effort. Soon learned that not all was apple pie and everything nice, but it certainly was a welcome change from where I had come from. So here I was in the Dorothy Day Catholic Worker House for real. It was noisy, filled with overflowing, mostly with women and young children, each woman hoping that work could be found for her or her spouse, if in fact she had a spouse. Those who volunteered to work here for 3 to 6 months or more, usually young college-age men and women, full of energy, generally eager to work and ready to do whatever needed to be done. They took folks to the employment office, to the doctor, to go pick up used furniture, clothes for the clothing room, or donations of one kind or another. This was all part of a day's work. Friday nights were set aside for discussion with a speaker coming in to help us keep abreast of current events or how we must be aware as Christians might respond to the problems and crises of the day. Barely 2 weeks after I moved into the Casa Maria, we heard Daniel Berrigan was to be speaking at Alverno College in Milwaukee about our moral response to the war in Vietnam. About 10 of us piled into a car to attend Dan's lecture. Were we impressed? There Dan sat on a small wooden stool in front of the audience of 200 or 300 people of all ages. He spoke gently, his words flowing almost poetically, but what he said was enough to tumble us off our seats if we fully grasped it. This war is unjust, inhumane, totally contrary to Jesus' teaching, and we must say no to it in a manner that is nonviolent and in the spirit of love, sums up his message. Dan invited all the priests in the audience to meet with him after his talk in a small room in the basement of the college. There must have been about 20 of us all together. Dan asked each of us to share briefly what we were doing to bring the evil of the war into the consciousness of those with whom we had lived and worked. And so we did. We at Casa Maria explained that in our Friday night open discussions, we had raised this very question and come up with many concrete ways the Catholic community could raise consciousness in a wider local community, appearing on radio talk shows, protesting against the ROTC program going on right on the campus of Marquette, doing some counseling regarding conscientious objection for young people reaching the draft age. All these we at Casa Maria and others in that room were already doing. After we shared these things, Dan informed us that there would be a retreat. It was being planned that would delve more deeply with hopes of arriving at some nonviolent direct action that would put the evil of the Vietnam War before the public eye. Dan invited all of us to come and bring others who might be interested. As interested as I was, the truth was that I had been in the Casa community for less than 3 weeks. I felt so good to finally be where I could live more simply, be in contact with those in dire need, and it seemed challenge enough to say no to the injustices in our local community. But to be going off to a retreat so soon after arriving in the community did not make sense to me. I decided to put the idea out of my mind. I had almost forgotten about the retreat. I was so involved with the work and the life at Casa when someone mentioned to me that 3 or 4 from Casa were planning to go and would leave the next day. Come along, they said. There is still enough room. It still didn't seem like the right thing to do. I made it clear that I would not be going. However, when I went to bed and began to think about the retreat and the reason it was being called, I realized that this was a matter of consciousness for me, and I'd better deal with it. By the time morning came, I had made the decision to go, and I needed only to inform those arranging one trip. It didn't dawn on me what I was getting into until I walked into the retreat center in the Benedictine Monastery in New Jersey and saw the number of people there. Among the crowd were other priests, religious sisters, prodigious clergy, and many lay women and men. Dan again was here with us, sitting on the floor with his Bible open to Exodus. The familiar old words sounded new this time. We are the chosen people of today, called out from slavery to journey to the promised land. We have many choices to make along the way, decisions that will demand the utmost from us. To be freed from slavery, we and our people must be united, committed, convinced, and be a people of faith, or we will not reach that promised land. And that was only the beginning of the weekend. It took no time at all to understand what the implications would be for us in the time of civil unrest here, but also for the people of Vietnam. The first day of the retreat helped us focus on the problem, getting the feel at home with the rest of the group and understanding the issues needing to be addressed. Did we all agree that something must be done to voice our disapproval of our country's involvement in the war? And if so, would we express this opposition in a forceful but totally nonviolent manner? I'm going to stop there, and I will read more in a few minutes after I pause for a song. Good evening, John. I was about to play a song after reading for 15 minutes.
Well, hello, Hammer, and how are you?
I'm good. Are you on a short sabbatical?
Well, at the moment, the coast is clear, and so I'm taking full advantage of the situation.
Well, I just got done reading 3 pages of Larry Rosebaugh's book, From Wisdom Through Failure. And he basically had been a priest for about 5 years at this point, and he went to Milwaukee to help Michael Cullen start and continue the Casa Maria House, a house for people who were immigrant workers, traveling, you know, people from Mexico and anybody who was homeless. And he based his inspiration on an Oblate mission, an Oblate founder of his priest order, Eugene de Mazenod, who said that to identify with the most abandoned and oppressed, you must try to be a voice for the voiceless. Now, just one more clip from Michael Cullen's book, because I read it last week and you liked it, about helping the poor. So I'm just going to read one line out of him. He was talking about Father Grappi, who I did a show with you and John one night about crossing the viaduct to help the black people find fair housing. So Michael Cullen was reflecting, really, this is tough stuff, living the Jesus life, trying to understand who he is as a man and a God, to talk about justice and to do things you really don't understand yourself. You wonder why in the heck you're in jail, why you're doing what you're doing. You know very well you could be living a halfway decent life somewhere in the world. And all the time, the same answer comes back. We are Christians, and what we are doing is the right thing to do. We don't need any other excuse. In my own life and in the lives of people like Grappi, Martin King, Cesar Chavez, the deepest motivation is faith. The man of faith really has to do with what he sees must be done, or his faith is empty and meaningless. The man of faith has a vision. He is able to cut through the rhetoric and the fear and say yes. He's able to say, I'm afraid, scared as hell, but it must be done. And so you look at the words of Jesus, and he feeds the hungry, and you know that is what you must do. People tell you, well, it's nice to feed the hungry, but don't feed them in my neighborhood. We don't want the bum and the panhandler in this neighborhood. And you become outraged and angry, but you go on feeding the hungry because it's God's law, and to stop feeding the hungry is to break God's law. If a man is hungry, you don't turn him away. You don't sit around to talk about it. You feed the man. The people in the neighborhood may try to run you out, burn you out, or kill you, but you go on doing God's law. That's what my faith is all about. That's what Jesus exemplifies. There's no more Greek, Roman, Jew, or Gentile. We are all brothers, and there is only one man and one woman and one child, as Carl Sandburg says. My dear mother in Ireland had taught me all of this, and I saw it lived in her. My training in the faith, my reading of the scriptures, the lives of saints, my study of theology, all of this prepared me. And then he talks about Father Grappi again. That's Michael Cullen, an Irish seminary student who opened a homeless shelter.
That's beautiful. And it's something that all Christians need to try to aspire to. And on top of that, there is a balance point to all that. And by that, I mean the life that Jesus lived, not necessarily the life that all Christians should live. And by that, I mean, I was talking to a friend today. They're just struggling with this. They're just being tormented, you know, because they can't find a balance point. And that is, there's a lot of things in Scripture that are almost contradictory. Like, it's kind of like, be accountable, pick up your cross, follow God, plan ahead and, do good works. And then the other part is like, let go and don't worry about it and have faith. And trust God, and is almost this contradictory kind of thing. Imagine this: you have a family, you got two or three kids and a wife, and you start to go Jesus style. Well, I quit my job, and we're just going to go out in the streets and start talking to people about the kingdom of heaven. It doesn't work when you have a five-year-old daughter. She needs to go to school, needs clothes. When Jesus picked his men for the mission, he didn't have any people with families, I mean, to bring along with them. They didn't bring along, you know, wives. They were single men or men who left everything, left their families, and they were on a mission. So what they were trying to figure out is how to live their life. I said it's kind of like this. Ecclesiastes and Proverbs talks about there's a time and place and a purpose for everything. There's a time to laugh, a time to dance. There's a time to sing, a time to cry. There's a time to give up everything. There's a time to be successful, because they were struggling with, I'm trying to succeed, trying to make money, but it seems like if I'm successful in the world, it's of the devil. It's not of, you know, the Christian way of picking up your cross and denial. And I told him, you know, if God has a plan in your life to be successful as a business person or as a musician or whatever, you should pursue that. That's your gift. Just to give it all up and to be nothing, I don't think that's fulfilling God's purpose.
Were they tempted to, like, just throw their 40-hour job away just to go, like, be a missionary somewhere?
Yeah, like preach the gospel or share it on the street, or just to not be materialistic, to live in a society of people where they give things and no one, you know, exchanges money, and or because money's evil and it's, you know. I said, well, no, it's rare. Jesus said all things are possible, but he said it's harder for a rich person to go into heaven. He gives all the examples, but basically it's hard if you have a business or if you have money or you have a beautiful wife or this or that to let go and follow God. But it doesn't mean you dump everything and become irresponsible, right? You know, a Christian in the old...
It's a bigger sacrifice to serve within the structure because a person feels trapped.
The Old Testament was basically laid down a whole lifestyle of being successful, of certain principles of being a family man, raising your family, being a man of respect, having a woman that, you know, takes care of the household. And in the culture, people would sit back and go, look at that person, he's got his thing together. Well, the problem with that is it was materialistic after a while, and the men's heart wasn't necessarily following God. It was just all about status, and, you know, he has nice clothes, and he has successful business, and therefore he's a great person, when inside maybe he's full of hate, maybe he's committing adultery on the side, things like that. So Jesus kind of came to give the other extreme, like, it's not what's going in your mouth, it's what's coming out of your mouth that's important. It's not what, you know, your external, it's your internal. But that's an extreme. So Christians struggle with, okay, well, then nothing means anything. You know, I don't want money, I don't want success, I don't want anything. I just want to be a homeless person who talks about God all the time. I think a Christian should be the best worker on the job. Should be the more successful athlete, because they have principles and concepts they use, because they're not proud, because they're humble, because they're giving. I know a lot of Christians is like, you wouldn't trust them with anything. They're flaky, right? They have no money. They have no career. They don't know how to do anything. They don't know anything about anything because they put their head in the ground. All they know is Bible scripture. And no one wants to deal with them because they're irresponsible. You wouldn't loan them any money because they never have money.
I think it depends on the person, because I knew this guy on disability, and he was from Texas, and he went to our church, First Baptist of Beverly Hills, but he could write music. He knew the scriptures backwards and forwards. And just kind of being around him, you felt spiritually fed. And he managed to, you know, have an apartment where he could sustain himself. He wasn't homeless or anything, but there was something in his nature that made people want to be around him.
And I mean, he wasn't a material guy, and that's the kingdom of God's not of such things. But imagine if you added three kids and a wife. Now, how does that work? Like, well,
yeah,
the kids,
at that point in his life, he didn't have one. Later on, he got married in Texas.
Uh-huh. And did he? Did he have a job or anything to support the family?
I'm not sure, but when I first met him, he was on disability. And then he got training at Sears to be a maintenance man, and he did that for a while. And then he moved, so I'm not really sure what his economic status was later on.
Yeah, because, I mean, basically you got to bring in some Benjamins to feed those mouths to handle the kids, or otherwise they're going to be hungry, and they're not going to have clothes, they're not going to have medical when they have any kind of health situation come up. You need a car to transport them. You need a shelter, a home. There's all kinds of stuff that goes into family life. And so just living a simple Jesus code, that's a hard thing to do if you're just going to be walking around with a bunch of 12 other guys going from town to town with no money or no job. You know, what are you going to tell your family? And they lived off of the support of people who did have money, who were working jobs, or their husbands had jobs, and they gave their money to Jesus. It's all good, but it's just there's a balance point in it. You know, if you're going to be in society and be a responsible person. But you can have all that stuff. You have a lot of money. You can have a career.
But not everybody is a family man, but they might be part of the family of God.
Well, everyone that's a human being was a child, and if you're a child, you had parents, and that means you were part of a family. So someone in that dynamic had to, right? You don't live on the street. Your parents don't panhandle. I mean, you can, but you know what I'm saying is we all had parents, and they all had jobs. Some of them, both people had jobs, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the dynamic. So what I'm saying is there's just a balance between being successful or having a job, raising your family, but keeping in mind that there's a more important family to be concerned about, the family of God, the kingdom of God. And staying on earth is just a demotion. Leaving this planet is a promotion.
Well, you can't – a lot of times you can't I don't mean self-exile, but you can't eject yourself from the planet. Sometimes God requires more service, time, and commitment, which we have no control over. But I want to read just one paragraph that Father Rosbaugh wrote about his parents. So just give me a second because it kind of relates to what you said. Okay, I'll just start with this page. I think it's oh, crap. It's a 21-page letter. Okay, here it is. Well, he said, I see all this. He had gone to visit his brother, John. I mean, his uncle, John, in the Rio Grande Valley, in which he raised horses, and there were scorpions in the sink, and they catch crabs in the river. But then after that trip, he had met a pastor on horseback, which is actually a priest. And he met him in the Rio Grande Valley, and the guy used to go from horseback to different churches. So later on, a couple of years later, he joined the Oblate, like the Jesuits. So he wrote, it's important, too, that I mention my mom and dad, two persons who lived out their Christian lives better than anyone I've known. My dad often said he would be content if there was always food for his family on the table. He wasn't then up with needing a new car, owning a new home, or the latest modern gadgets. The church, daily mass, the family, the rosary were most important to both my mom and dad. Solutions to all problems were sought through prayer, through fasting, and much sacrifice on their part. These simple essentials in life have to this day been the most important elements to take me throughout all of these years. So that was just a short paragraph he wrote out of the 21-page letter about
right.
his parents.
So I guess to put in perspective what I was trying to say is that what I related to this person is that Ecclesiastes tells there's a time and place and a purpose for everything under the sun. There's that time for you to have your career, time for you to have your family, time for you to raise your kids. There's a time for you to be on a mission. There's a time for you to follow, you know, God and do spiritual things no matter what, because in the end, that's what's important. And that Jesus didn't come to do away with the old. He came to fulfill it. So you don't take all the stuff from the Old Testament, throw it away and go, it doesn't apply. He says, not one jot or tittle will pass away till all is fulfilled. It's all part of the big picture. And people who just live only, you know, I'm on the street with Jesus handing out Bible tracts, that's, for most people, that's not the whole picture. You know, maybe if God's called you for a mission or if that's your calling, that's great. But some people, God's called to have a family or to have a career and to share Jesus in that career. It's when you're playing at that club or you're working your job at the loading dock that you're sharing Jesus, that Christians may not be there. Missionaries may not be there. So we all have our place. It's being a responsible, solid person of convictions. That's what's an effective, you know, witness for God. Sometimes we try to reach the whole world. We see millions of people lost and we go, oh, it's such a daunting task. Reach one person, your neighbor, or two people a year. See, all you have to do is reach, you know, one or two people in your lifetime and you've done your part. Because if everyone did their part, everyone would reach the whole world. It's just baby steps, but we get overwhelmed by millions and millions. No, just take care of the person next to you or your inner circle. If everyone does that, everyone's going to get reached in some way.
Yeah, I remember when I was a Navy wife in Virginia and my faith was pretty strong. Like, I would memorize Bible verses every day when Craig was at sea, my first husband. And I led two people to God. And one of the people I led to God, she's still a very dynamic Christian. Her son went to CBN University, Christian Broadcasting Network University. And now he's like an actor in New York and successful actor on Off-Broadway. And he still has a strong, her own son has a Christian foundation and married a Christian from CBN. And I just wish I could have reached a few more people with all the bumps I've had in the road.
Oh, yeah.
But I have had a struggle since I had my son, and now I have a little more freedom now that he'll be 18 in about a week. So I don't really, I could go out and street witness and stuff like that. There's one church in Duluth that does do it on a regular basis.
Well, here's a question. You believe in God. Was that because of someone preaching to you on the street, or was it because your parents raised you in church?
I was raised in a church, and then when I was 23, I recommitted myself to Christ, more like 22, and then I got re-energized, you know, through that Christian faith.
And same thing with your sister. She was raised up in church, right?
Yeah, and then she's the one who led me to the Baptist church in my early 20s, and then I stopped drinking after I left college.
And I was raised in the church, and that's where I got my primary, you know, fundamentals and faith in God and believe in the Bible. And when I was 8 or 9, I accepted the Lord. And I think when I was like an early teen, I really, you know, recommitted or had a more serious awareness. Because at 9, it's hard to really consider life and make a life, you know. Yeah, I mean, you can dedicate your life to Jesus, but you still don't even understand. You don't even understand what a girlfriend really is, or sex, or war, or death. I mean, these are just concepts you kind of get thrown at you, and, you know, sacrifice for sin. I mean, it's like, you know, who really understands the totality of sin? There's sins you don't even understand at 8 or 9. But I did make, you know, a commitment to God, and then when I was older and I really understood a lot more, I reaffirmed that commitment, fully understanding bigger things in life. And but it's because of my parents, because I was raised that way. Same thing with my brother. Same thing with my parents. They were raised to believe in God, and their sisters and brothers were. What I'm saying is maybe 10% or 20% of the people I've ever met, probably even less, ever made a commitment to God because of some street preacher on a corner. They were usually raised in church, or they sought out a church in times of crisis and, you know, moral indecision.
But
and,
I do know people who have had moments of truth where, like, something somebody said or a story or they went through a tragedy and somebody witnessed to them. Like, you don't just have a linear salvation timeline.
It's a combination of stuff. But what I'm saying is 80 to 90% of the people I know, their primary indoctrination was being raised in church. That's something that stayed with them. And then, you know, there's a 10% layer of people that kind of encounter others. I wouldn't even say it's street witnessing. It's more like, oh, they had a friend at work and that friend invited them to a concert, or they went camping and, you know, the person was struggling with some issues and they said, you know, well, do you know the Lord? And then, you know, it's kind of more of a one-on-one, but not so much the I'm going out today and meeting people I've never met. It was more relationship on relationship, right? It's like, oh, yeah, George in the print shop, you know, wants to go bowling, and you're out there talking about life, and he's like, man, I feel these thoughts of, you know, suicide and blah, 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 and you start sharing. It's like, well, I used to have those thoughts, but God changed, you know, my life. And they're like, really, you know? And it's like, and then pretty soon they start asking, you know, how can, you know, can you pray with me? I think that's more of how most people get that born-again experience.
I think so, too. It usually comes to a more direct personal inspiration. Like, even my pastor, when I died, he showed me this book, The Mystery of the Tao, which is about energy on Earth and how You like even out your energy. But he also, of course, I've also had, like, you were one of the people who were instrumental in my life in LA. Like, when I first started at that company we worked at, and you witnessed to me, and then I brought a couple friends to your church a few times to hear your concerts. And then
right.
We developed a Christian bond. And other people in the Baptist church, like Yale and Gil and Tony Howard. And I built a really strong foundation of believers in the Christian church in Beverly Hills. Plus, we started our own theater ministry. So all that stuff, like, there's been even like the LA Times, I only worked there a year and a half, but I have 5 lifelong friendships from that group, including Don. So you can't.
Wow.
The only problem that I have, a occupational hazard, or I guess a personality flaw, is that I was kind of a vagabond my whole life, like wanting to move from place to place. And that spirit didn't die out in me even after becoming a wife and a mother. I still have like a tendency to want to run once every 3 years. So I'm not the person to talk to about building a strong family.
Well, then the Jesus lifestyle is perfect for you. Just, you know, hit the road and don't look back.
Well, this is one thing, maybe you can relate to this. It sounds rather trivial. Like, so I have relatives coming in 4 days. They're coming on Wednesday. So I have about 6 chairs in my house, and Lauren broke 2 because of his size. And it's like, the non-material side of me doesn't want to buy more chairs, but I bought a $60 rug, and now I'm going to wait 2 weeks to buy a nice chair, even though the relatives are coming in a few days. Like, I don't really like investing in material things because I never know how long I'm going to live somewhere. You know, like,
right.
Sometimes it's just trivial decisions that, like, your whole life philosophy is embroidered around these trivial decisions about what you want to invest in versus what you don't want to invest in?
Well, it's been helping me lately. It's working pretty well. I always try different philosophies and ideas, and I get on little kicks and tangents, and I run them for about 2 weeks to a month, and then until they run into the ground, you know, with some fatal flaw, whether it's being in military mode or it's being in Mr. Efficiency mode or perpetual motion mode or radical Christian mode, you know, all kinds of, because each one has a different thought or a different structure of how you make decisions, right? Radical Christian guy gets up and first thing he's like, we got to pray for, you know, 30 minutes before we do anything. And everything is, what does God want me to do? And it's like, well, I think God wants you to put some pants on and go to work and pay your bills. But, you know, but that's kind of like, well, maybe God wants me to quit my job today and go on street witness. So you kind of have to balance that. And then, you know, perpetual motion man is like, I don't have 30 minutes to pray, or I'll pray as I'm driving because I'm constantly in motion doing something. There's no, you know, and each mode has its different thing, but one that's really working well in the situation I'm in my work situation, is I don't care. And you would say, oh, that's terrible. No, I care, but I don't care that much. I don't care to the point where I compromise things or where I get obsessed. Like, example, the screen door was open. You must have left the screen door open. Well, the first answer is no, I don't touch the screen door. Well, no, you had to because no one else is here and the dog went and I'll leave the screen door open. Now, at this point, the I don't care kicks in. It's like, okay, so I left it open or someone did. It's like, I don't care. As compared to, no, I'm telling you the truth. You had to leave the door open or you or someone because I don't do that. And then it'd be like, why are you so negative? And it's like, I'm not being negative. I'm just telling the truth. But you don't have to be sarcastic with me. I'm not being sarcastic. And boom, 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 you got a whole big argument. Instead, it's like, oh, okay, whatever. Fine. I'm a bad boy.
I think the one thing is that if I notice sometimes I listen to the audio Bible on Bible Gateway because I like listening to it, like when I'm doing my work downstairs at work. And it's easier than reading and looking up verses, but I think let me just tell you just one thing before I get, I'm going to read this Bible verse quick out of Matthew 13. First of all, security to me means I have this kind of job where I can add overtime a lot, so I'm happy to have that type of security. Then I'm also happy, like when my car is running good, those are important. I'd rather put money in my car than, like, buying new household things like I just mentioned. But sometimes we get choked up by the cares of the world, like this parable is about to say, because we have so many cares and concerns that we just feel choked up by everything, like we're being blindsided with all our problems. So at that point, I think you're right. You have to figure out a time to pray, even if you're on your bike or driving to work, because you can get choked up with the cares of the world pretty easily. So I know you have limited time, so just interrupt me if you need to. But the same, I'm going to read Matthew 13, verses 1 through 11, but they're not that long. That same day, Jesus went out to the house and sat by the lake. Large crowds gathered around him, and he got into a boat and sat in it while all the people stood on the shore. Then he told them many things in parables. A farmer went out to sow a seed, and as he was scattering the seed, some fell along the path, and the birds came and ate it up. Some fell on rocky places, where it did not have much soil. It sprang up quickly, but because the soil was shallow, when the sun came up, the plants were scorched, and they withered because they had no root. Other seed fell among thorns, which grew and choked up the plants. Still, other seeds fell on good soil where it produced a crop 160 or 30 times what was sown. Whoever has ears, let him hear. The disciples came to him and asked, why do you speak to people in parables? He replied, because the knowledge of the secrets of the kingdom of heaven has been given to you, but not to them. Whoever has will be given more, and they will have abundance. whoever does not have, even what they have will be taken from them. Well, basically what he was trying to say is that a lot of people listen to the gospel, but they just, it's just like a temporary fix, you know, like a healing for a wound, but they don't really take it to heart. And then they go back and live their own kind of way. But people who do listen, God will prosper their lives. I think we lost John. Yep, his call dropped. He'll be calling back in a minute. Sometime he's in an area in Marina Del Rey where the phone service cuts off easily. So if the Dark Master returned, he won't be able to return the phone call. So we've been on the air 45 minutes, and what John and I have been trying to advocate tonight is that whether you come from a place like Lawrence Rosebaugh, who he actually started out his life, you know, with the American apple pie values of loving baseball and sports. He was a prom king. But then he heard God's call through his uncle's friend, a priest, who rode on horseback. And because he was a product of the times where the civil rights movement was going on and the disparity of the Vietnam War and all the deaths in there, he heard the call of wanting to help the poor and the needy. He got the right kind of training through the Oblates Immaculate, and he started a life of servitude, which lasted his whole life through Recife, Brazil, and Central America. He was later carjacked and killed in the late 90s. But now his story is known worldwide. In the same way, Bob Groff, out of Milwaukee, who was another seminarian and a Jesuit, became involved in the Milwaukee 14 action. And he was close friends with Mike Cullen and many other people in that upbeat neighborhood. They all heard a call to serve God beyond what they could serve. They took into the consideration and the needs of others who were in worse situations than them. Now, on the part of nobility, they also extended their sympathy to the Vietnam women and children who were dying on a regular basis because of bad foreign policy war action on behalf of the Americans. Not to say that those sons who went over there wanted to engage in that type of behavior, but they were forced through military planning to take out certain villages and lives of people. That was a coming of age in American society where Michael Cullen and Father Grappi helped the blacks of Milwaukee liberate their unequal housing and transform it into more, you know, equitable living for people to liberate through their nonviolent actions and burn draft cards, which was a radical move, but also led by a courageous group of religious clerics. Those are times that have come and gone, things that we do not see in America anymore. Now we're reliant on the corporate talking heads of television, and we don't see much individual leadership in the community unless it's within our own church body and we're inspired locally. Some people can get it through reading, you know, people's books and personal biographies. With that, I know John might try to call back in, but I'm going to end the show because this is our midweek show. And what I'll do is I'm going to read another excerpt from The Time to Dance, starting on page, I'm going to start in the 80s. We've already covered one radio show where we talked about the Freedom House, the burning of the Freedom House in Milwaukee a few weeks ago. So I'm going to start with Michael Collins, Chapter 5, which is ironically the same chapter of Larry Rosebaugh's book, To Wisdom Through Failure. This book is called A Time to Dance. The Mike Collins story as told to Don Ranley. So I'm just going to finish out the show with a couple of pages of his description. The philosophy of the Catholic worker movement was already operating in our lives long before the group of us got serious about a shelter for homeless families. But now it was time to do something. Mike McCann, a member of the group, began proceedings to incorporate the Catholic Worker House as a legitimate organization of the state of Wisconsin. We weren't at all sure just what we were incorporating, but we felt it was the right thing to do. I believe we felt that if a hospitality house evolved, it would be just one part of a larger movement. Father Maurice has told us of the need of a shelter for migrant families. Another man named Jesus Pagan, and then he makes a joke. In Spanish, that name comes across okay, but not in English. Another man, Jesus Pagan, kept telling us of this tremendous need. There was a house next to an old church, which once was a post office. The church used to be Our Lady of Guadalupe, and it served the Spanish Americans who had moved into the area. Another church, also an ethnic parish called Holy Trinity, was close by. Since the Holy Trinity Church had very few parishioners left, the diocese closed down. Our Lady of Guadalupe combined it with the Holy Trinity. Anyway, the rectory of Our Lady of Guadalupe was empty, and the diocese had no plans for it. We found we could rent it for $100 a month. The diocese paid the electricity and gas. Now all we needed was for someone to move in and take charge. Nettie and I felt we were still free enough in our lives to do this. We were not bound by the economic slavery of the society. Besides, we felt it was the right thing to do. But we had no blueprint to say how to set up the house. The Catholic worker movement in New York City was basically serving Bowery men and Skid Row men. They were not dealing with families, and this was all new for us. This would have to be a very new kind of community, a different kind of house. The only thing we knew is that we would move in and live there. We moved in late August 1966. It was here that my real baptism took place. The abstract now became concrete. I continued on as an insurance salesman because I didn't know how I was going to get income. There was no money given to us as a salary from anybody, and that includes the diocese. Basically, Nettie and I felt that we were called to serve. That serving would be mainly to migrant workers. Migrant workers, usually Mexican-American from the deep south, are very visible in northern Wisconsin in the fall, as they are in many other states. The salaries of these seasonal workers are absurdly low in terms of travel and time spent not working. Often the families have not earned enough money to travel back to their homes in southern Texas. The poverty of the migrant camps had been exposed time and time again, but little or nothing is being done about it. Some of the migrants come into the city to escape the poverty, but often end up further disillusioned. They are often not at all equipped to live in the city, let alone possess the skills necessary to earn a decent living. And so we found out these migrant families sleeping in cars along the lakefront or abandoned cars, or we found them in abandoned and condemned houses. Often they didn't have a chance to make a beginning, sometimes merely because they didn't have the money to pay their first month's rent. How does a man get a job when he is looking for a place to live? And how does one pay rent until the first paycheck comes? All of this would be difficult enough, but there was or is the added problem of the language barrier. It is difficult to deal with the enormity of the problem since it lies outside the experience of most of us. Moving day finally came for Nettie and me and Willie. Willie was his son. A friend let us use his truck to haul the furniture we had in Cedarburg. The stuff was scattered all over our new home, but we were so tired. We went to bed at 11. About 1 a.m., there was a knock on the door. A woman who could speak no English made it clear to us that she needed a place to stay. I couldn't believe it. How is it possible? Who told her about us? The house, a former rectory for some 4 or 5 priests, had 4 major bedrooms and another large room we made into a bedroom. My wife and the baby and I occupied only one room. There was no furniture in the place. The priests took it all with them. But we began collecting things, especially mattresses and beds. Because one thing's for sure, the Spanish Americans came just as we have been told they would. From that first night on, they came and they kept coming. Neither Nettie could nor I could speak Spanish, but what came across was that we were all human beings, brothers and sisters. We didn't have to speak words to let people know we really cared, that we were deeply concerned, that we were very happy to give them shelter, that our house was truly an open house, open to anyone and everyone at all times. I'm not sure when we got down to the business of finding a name for our house. The group of us had a meeting and agreed that it should have something to do with Mexican-American, Spanish-American culture. For centuries now, Mary, the Mother of Christ, had been such a part of that culture. We decided that we'd call the House of Mary, Casa Maria. We kept that name even when we moved to another house and even though we served people of all nationalities and religions. The name gave us an identity. Before long, reporters were coming around and Casa Maria became known to the city of Milwaukee. One story by Ethel Gintoft, which appeared in the Milwaukee Archdiocese newspaper, the Catholic Herald Citizen, was reprinted in a small Catholic magazine, The Precious Blood Messenger, and also in the Catholic Digest. And so in a few short months, we were known to the nation, and though we could hardly believe that such a small effort, such a small Christian venture, should get such publicity, we were deeply grateful. We needed all the support we could get. The publicity also showed us that people are attracted by the Gospels, that living the Gospels was not a complicated theological matter, that it took no great mind to see the rightness of the sheltering the homeless and the feeding of the hungry. But as we had to be expected, different people had different ideas as to how Casa Maria would be run. Some thought the house should be a center for mobilizing Mexican Americans. Some thought the house should be a very traditionally governed house serving a specific function like an agency of some kind. But Nettie and I had our own ideas about Casa Maria. I was beginning to really move with the gospel. The gospel was very much permeating my reason for living in Casa Maria. For example, I wanted no part of a salary for working at Casa Maria, for serving the poor. It didn't make any sense to me. I began to feel a real call for voluntary poverty. Hence, I felt it very necessary to beg for our food. I felt it was necessary to involve the community, the Christian community, the whole community. The community had to have a part of our work, a real part, a real personal involvement, not just by the way of giving money to some special fund. The Gospels demand, the Gospels demand, Christians serve the poor by feeding him and clothing him, and right from the beginning, that was operating in our head. So I'll read another chapter Sunday night. Thank you for listening and have a good night.